The sound of praise for your Sunday morning.
The only one who could ever teach me.
Introducing Reverend A.R. Bernard of the Christian Cultural Center.
Was the son of a preacher man.
And Rabbi Joseph Potasnik of Religion on the Line.
The only one who could ever teach me.
Now, on Talk Radio 77 WABC, here's the Reb and the Rabbi, where faith matters.
Good morning, I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
And I'm Reverend A.R. Bernard.
Reverend, we have two great guests today. We want to take a little bit of time to talk about something that was so disturbing for people of all faiths. And that is what happened at St. Patrick's Cathedral, the disruption of an Easter service. You would think that'd
the
be...
Right? Yeah, the biggest day of our religious calendar year. Easter is such a special day globally. And people intentionally chose that day to disrupt. And again, Rabbi, how many times have you and I talked about the invasion of sacred spaces, the disrespect for what was at one time held to be sacred? And this is not the first time. This is the second time within a month. Because remember, there was another situation. I think it was a funeral, remember? And there was a protest at St. Patrick's that broke out during the funeral. And now we have Easter, a very sacred and the most prominent holiday in our faith. And it happens again. What do we say?
You know, it's hard to find the words to describe the disgust with that behavior. If you speak about respect today, people look at you and say, well, that's old-fashioned. You have to, you know, it's got to be in your face. You have to talk about what you're feeling. You don't have to hide it. As if you can't respectfully disagree. You can't respectfully protest. We've lost the, you know, that important component of society, basic respect for the other. We talk about the dignity of the individual, and yet you and I talk about it, and others do not think it's necessary.
Yeah. I like what you said. It's corny. It's out of fashion. It's antiquated. What is popular is we scream at each other. We demonize each other and then go our separate ways. Humanity is not going to last long like that, Rabbi. It's not healthy.
But we can't retreat. I think we have a responsibility to continue to speak out as forcefully, as frankly as possible, so that at least people know there are those who oppose this behavior, that you get away with it, but you shouldn't get away with it without a price. I know these people were arrested, but of course, given the history of what happens with many arrests, you know, they'll be released immediately. But I think we cannot walk away from this immediately. We have to continue to set an example of what real disagreement can be, predicated on respect. And also, people need to be held accountable for the wrongs they commit.
And people can disagree and still work together on common ground. You and I attended a meeting this past week with faith leaders, Black and Jewish faith leaders, to talk about working together. And I stopped counting how many times we were pointed to as a model of individuals who have their independent beliefs and yet can work together. And it's going to take modeling these things. People have to see what it looks like when two individuals from different faith persuasions find common ground and build personal relationships that they can work together.
And it's not difficult. If you really care, it's not difficult. We're going to be talking soon with an individual who really has made a lot of news over the years. I'm talking about former Governor David A. Patterson, then later on with former Attorney General Bob Abrams. But David Patterson did something recently that caught the attention of many, and we'll be discussing that with him.
Yeah, so it's going to be a great program. Don't you touch that dial. Keep it right here on 77 WABC. We'll be right back. The Rev and the Rabbi.
Where faith matters. The Rev and the Rabbi. Talk Radio 77 WABC.
Welcome back. I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
And I'm Reverend A.R. Bernard.
Reverend, I have with me, and you, the 55th governor of the state of New York. He hasn't been on air that many times. I looked at the book, and he's 5,000 hours behind Curtis. So I thought having him on the air with us, you know, move him up a little bit. Welcome, Governor David A. Patterson.
Thank you both. It's good to be here.
Governor, when I was talking to you today before the show, you mentioned something very, very interesting about your history with George Latimer, who you recently endorsed running against Jamal Bowman. Talk about that. And there was somebody else that you endorsed who became very successful.
Well, it goes back to 2002 or around that time when I ran against the minority leader of the Senate and won. So now I've won, and you know there was a little publicity about it, and I was saying that in a few years we'd take the majority. And most of my colleagues in the other House, and I'm talking about the Democratic colleagues, were laughing. This will never happen. The former Speaker Mel Miller said that, you know, I was, trying to accomplish something that would never be done, and this whole thing. And during that time, there were two assembly members who, unlike the rest, came to visit me with some advice as for how to do it. One of them was Tom DiNapoli, and Tom was talking to me about Long Island. He knew I'd grown up there, and he, you know, talked about some openings he thought were possible. And the other one was someone I never met before, and that was George Latimer. And this is his first session in the assembly, and he just started going through all these possibilities in Westchester. He said, you're going to have to win two seats in Westchester if you're going to take the majority. He goes through this whole thing. And then I think maybe he wasn't sure that I got everything he told me. So everything he said to me, he wrote it down and sent it to me. And we used a lot of the information he gave us. So, of course, that led to a really good friendship between myself and him. And then county executive, I thought it was a perfect role for him because he really is a planner and an organizer, and a lot of the difficult work that really requires real intellectual thinking and also a feel for the catchment area of the public, he has that. And that's why it was my privilege to endorse him in this race that he's in right now for Congress.
Now, Governor, that created some heat for you because you chose Latimer over Bowman, Jamal Bowman, right? Who is a Democratic incumbent. And you just go around doing this anyway. What say you?
Well, there is a type of advocacy sometimes that comes across as antagonistic and comes across as out of the box and that type of thing. And that's where I think the current congressman is. But in my opinion, that's where too many people are, not just him, on both sides of the aisle. Real strident points of view and very little communication. And most of the dialogue turns out to be acrimony. So, you know, it wasn't necessarily him. It's just a style right now. They have names for different groups of legislators that work together. And to me, it's kind of pedantic. It's the kind of thing that, you know, people did in high school. And I don't think the public office is the place for that. And so that's, didn't make it that hard a choice. Although I heard that when Congressman Bowman found out that I endorsed George Latimer, that he ran down the stairs and out of his house and went down the block and set off a fire alarm.
But he didn't know it was a fire alarm.
Well, what he should know is this is the real emergency, the one he's in now.
Well, I can just tell you this. On behalf of so many of us in the Jewish community, thank you for not endorsing Jamal Bowman, because his position vis-a-vis Israel has really been an abomination for us. I mean, he has said some horrible things, certainly not in the best interest of Israel. And now he's leading in the polls. I saw recent poll numbers that showed that Latimer is really much ahead.
They had a poll in January when he was trying to decide whether or not he should do this, and he was about 9 points down. They did a poll recently that showed they were basically even. And then right as he's making the announcement, they took another poll that shows him, I think it was 17 points ahead, 52 to 35 with 15 undecided. That's a big lead. Now, you know, he's going to have to stick to what's always been, I think, his the mark of his service, which is when you read his biography, he grew up in some really nice towns in Westchester, towns that I don't think they would even let me and the Reverend go in at that particular time. And yet he wanted to know all different types of people. He went to Fordham. You know, he really was a person that wanted to be part of everything that was going on. And I think that's why he has such a big following outside his own neighborhood. And not many elected officials that have achieved that goal.
Well, he's got a lot to defend now, because I don't think he thought Latimer had a chance against him. I think that he felt comfortable and didn't expect that former governor would undermine him, because that's what you did, Governor.
Yeah, well, this is a contact sport.
And you're a WABC.
Yeah. And so he'll have the opportunity to have that at me at some point when he feels like it. But I think what really is disturbing about some of his remarks, and particularly remarks since October 7th, is the fact that why would you pick a crisis and why would you pick a tragedy to start questioning the motives of the people who were the victims of it. This is the first time in my life that I've ever seen this happen. And it's not just him. It's a whole lot of people who are actually doing it. And listen, there is a long history. I mean, President Biden says that he wants to have a ceasefire through a two-state solution. I'm sorry, Mr. President, but they've been talking about two-state solutions for 5,000 years over there. And I don't think that that's going to get solved right away. But, you know, he is working to try to do something. He's trying to make sure that we are keeping our promise that he made to Israel right on the day of the attack. And yet, at the same time, there are a lot of voices in the Democratic Party that are antithetical to what the president's trying to do and what so many people are trying to do. And it's hard to negotiate with an entity whose sole purpose is to eliminate the Jewish people, whether they're in Israel or wherever they are, to drive them into the sea. That was where, you know, from
the Hamas charter.
Exactly. And I know that people have taken different stands. And I'll tell you something. It's Sunday morning and it's in April. If we went back 56 years to today, so that would be April 7th, 1968. That would be the weekend on which Martin Luther King was murdered on that Thursday night, which was also April 4th. And so what, you know, whenever his birthday comes around and, you know, people honor him, they honor him and then try to put his voice to a message that is antagonistic to what he always spoke for. And so what I tried to follow in this endorsement, and really as much as I can in my life, is to demonstrate to others fairness. And I didn't think that that was happening in this case. And that's why I decided to want to lend my voice to the party who I thought was most fair.
Explain something to me. Something to me about, I hear the call for the ceasefire. So what does that mean? Talk to families who are living in the South and say, we want you to go back home and we're going to go back to October 6th, knowing that there's going to be an October 7th. Tell me what a ceasefire means. We cease and they fire. I mean, what is the message there? How do you promise a family that you can live securely by putting the same players back in Gaza?
Well, that's the exact reason why, for the most part, the Israelis are not accepting that. Because a ceasefire, what it means to me, is giving the adversary time to reload.
Absolutely. I'm glad you pointed that out, Rabbi and Governor. So where do we go with this continued tension in Israel. What's the solution, Governor?
I don't think I know one right now. This is such a difficult situation. And of course, there was another tragedy when the Israelis mistook a feeding center and where they were keeping food and treating people for illnesses and blew it up. And a lot of people were killed and hurt. And, you know, and there was an apology issued by the prime minister. But there are just so many ways that this could be a catastrophic lesson in history for all of us that I can't say that I have a prediction for what's happening going forward. Perhaps.
Yeah. And I go ahead.
Perhaps the faith leaders on this planet of all ethnicities and of all colors and of all geographic locations might find a way to come together and lead the way. No one talks to the UN anymore because they have absolutely no power in any situation. But that would be a thought I would have for perhaps something to try to alleviate what could be a really, really horrible conclusion if this situation escalates.
Yeah, and the reason I ask is not just to make conversation, but the reality is this is going to heavily influence our election cycle. We're facing an election for a new president or a continued president, and I think that voters are going to make up their mind around this critical issue.
I think the former president is going to have somewhat of an advantage because he is going to talk about situations where he said during his administration he threatened foreign powers and they shut it down. I think he's going to get a chance to say that. And it's going to put the current president in a difficult position because he hasn't said that. He was seen to be moving that way on October 7th after he heard about what happened. That was sort of his instinct. But he's gotten caught now. And in many respects, he's getting pressure from both sides. And that's always a difficult place to run from, even though I think he's trying 100% to try to solve the problem.
So let me understand something. You mentioned Hamas with a charter to destroy Jews, not just Israel, but to remove all the Jews. You have October 7th. Why isn't the burden or the finger pointing against Hamas? Why is it against Israel? You know, I was listening to Brett Stevens the other evening. He said, you know, if you have, unfortunately, a cancerous tumor, in order for you to survive, you got to remove the tumor. How does anyone say to Israel, cease fire, keep things as they were, keep that tumor in your body, and expect Israel to accept that?
I think it's an excuse. People come up with things that happened 60 years ago, things that happened 150 years ago, and things that happened nearly 1,000 years ago to try to buttress their argument that it's Israel's responsibility to bring an end to this crisis. Someone asked Hillary Clinton, did she believe in a ceasefire? And she said, I thought they were having a ceasefire on October 6th. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly, I think, what the issue is, that there are many who I'm really beginning to think that it's just blatant anti-Semitism, mm-hmm. just blatant that. I mean, there were times when people said things to me and they, you know, kind of spiced it up to look one way, but I knew it was a racist remark. And I think what we're hearing are people who are making suggestions, but it is actually serving as a cover for how they really feel, which is they don't really care whether Israel survives or not.
Thank you for saying that.
Thank you as a
Christian. You know, I hear Reverend Bernard, I heard you say one evening, I stand with Israel very clearly, very forthrightly, and your record is one that is very, very steadfast in its commitment. We want to hear, need to hear Christians say it's anti-Semitism as well, because if Jews say it, somehow it doesn't have credibility. Like, we don't know what anti-Semitism is. But when a Christian says this is anti-Semitism, it has much more gravitas in the world today.
Very much like in the late 50s and 60s, how it was so important for there to be white leaders who came out and condemned the segregation, the lynchings of people for no reason, the failure to recognize marriage in the southern states, and all that was really a precept for racism, and nobody would call it for what it was. And then if you called it that way, then for some reason, why are you saying this? Well, because it was actually happening. And here we are 60 years later, it's happening to a different group of people. But the same good people who had the intestinal fortitude to stand up then should be standing up now.
You know, I Pew Research Center did a poll on people's feelings about the war, this conflict, and they found that most Americans report having strong emotional reactions to the war. Yet, for the most part, Americans are really not paying attention to the news that's coming out about the conflict. It's like they've taken an emotional position, and that's it. They don't need any further conversation or evidence to support the position that they've taken. Is this typical of what's happening in our nation?
Yes, I think, you know, when I was growing up, I was part of sort of integrating a school that had a significant Jewish population. And it's interesting, the friendships I made there, I think, stayed longer than any other place that I met people in life. But I remember when I was in the state Senate that every time it was either Louis Farrakhan or Khalid Muhammad, or every time one of them said something, I got a phone call, you need to come out and condemn this. And I really would get annoyed. And these were friends of mine who were telling me to do this. And, you know, I would say, you know, something, all I'm doing is creating another opportunity for them to live off of these reactions that they get when they say things. You know, if we all ignore them, they might go away. But then, as time went on, and I read about what happened at Kristallnacht and how there were all kinds of threats of violence for weeks before the attack, I realized that this was not something that was really similar to what went on, you know, back in the 60s during the civil rights movement. This was a real attack that the people saw coming. And who's going to blame, you know, the next generation or the generation for that after that for having that tremendous fear? And from, you know, friends I have now of the Jewish faith, when I talk to them, I get behind what they say an incredible fear that they can't get their arms around right now, because nobody exactly knows what the next chapter in this horrible episode is going to be.
I've never heard so many people in my community asking, could it happen here? I used to hear it sporadically, but now when they think back to the Holocaust and they're seeing all of these demonstrations, ugly epithets, you know, kill the Jews, Hitler was right, they're now asking, could it happen in America? And many of them think it could happen here. What do you think, Governor?
Well, I would never have thought that some terrorists could get two planes to slam into 210-story buildings and knock them both down within an hour and a half. And so September 11th was a wake-up call for me. And I'm trying not to let this situation be a wake-up call. I'm trying to speak so that other people can wake up and we can stop it.
You know, I think that's important, because we can't live in fear, even though the possibility that anything can happen. We just don't know. We've been convinced, or should be convinced by now, that anything can happen. But we have to keep dialogue going on. Rabbi, you and I attended a meeting that was hosted by Mayor Adams to bring Black and Jewish faith leaders together to talk about the tension and to talk about ways that we can begin to come against the anti-Semitism and to heal relationships. And it was, I thought it was a pretty good meeting. There needs to be follow-up and outcome. What were your thoughts, Rabbi?
You know, I looked around the room and I realized I was sitting with people I had known for many years. and people who have always stood with the Jewish community and Jews who had stood with the Black community. There's a relationship. And when you develop relationships, you can have a very positive outcome. And I think what we need to do is expand the relationships. And also when I walked in the room, I noticed there were the pictures of Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman right in front of us. And I looked at those and I said to myself, we have a responsibility to them so that that doesn't happen again. And the only way we're going to do that is by sitting down and knowing one another and getting young people to talk to each other. It's good to get young people to go into a museum. I get it. But there's got to be conversation with one another. They have to know who was a Jew. What pains this person? Have to know from African-American. What pains your community? The more we know, the more difficult it is to demonize and destroy the other. Governor?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Reverend, go ahead.
Reverend?
No, I was just going to say one of the things that was important in that setting is that it was a safe space. Mm-hmm. Everyone felt comfortable enough to express themselves and be honest. And some were, you know, quite honest in the process. We have to create these safe spaces for dialogue, healthy dialogue, and debate. Governor?
I think that that kind of dialogue is missing from so many places. Whenever I'm in one of those types of meetings, as the two of you described that you were in with Mayor Adams, I always think the only problem is that the wrong people are talking about it.
Yeah.
The people that are talking about it, they get along with each other very well.
Right.
They don't see the boundaries between us. And the question is really going to be how to get a greater population of individuals on this whole planet to recognize the similarities as opposed to the divisions which inevitably lead to conflict.
Governor, we're coming to the end of the segment. I just want to ask you this.
Why, Reverend? I mean, a rabbi?
Well, because Ava...
He calls it.
Ava
no,
is pointing...
No, you're right. You're asking me why.
Yeah, right.
Because rabbi,
Ava
rabbi
is
calls
pointing,
the shots.
Is
I'm
pointing
just getting
at me.
Warmed
whatever
up.
Ava says as the producer, okay. We have to listen to. But one last question.
Okay.
Why is it so wrong for you or anyone else to endorse someone that you think is better qualified to have the position? Why is there this Pavlovian kind of response expected? He's an incumbent, you got to endorse him. He's a Democrat, you got to endorse him. Why can't you take the position, I'm endorsing the person I think is better for the job?
Well, I'm going to take it one step further because I was going to say this earlier and deal with the elephant in the room. How can you go up against a Black guy and pick a white guy, Governor?
Well, if I didn't do it that way, then I would be continuing a pattern of conduct where people like myself were a victim of years ago. So in other words, as a Black candidate, I actually won a state Senate seat in the predominantly white district, which was the Upper West Side and Harlem. And even though Harlem was in the district, the greater number of people were white. Had they not been able to choose me over one of my candidates was white, what are we all doing here? I made that choice because I really thought that one of the two candidates in that race was starting to go off the rails. And interestingly enough, I teach a class on Black Jewish relations every Thursday for Torah University. And I laid out to them this past Thursday everything that happened and asked them what they thought. And they were harder on Congressman Bowman than anyone else I'd heard, and particularly the Black students. They even were making up names for him. Mm. But so what I'm saying is that when there's change, that change just can't be for that moment in time. It's got to be forever. So if I was trying to convince white people to work for a Black candidate, at some point I had to be open to the fact that the white candidate is really carrying the message that the people of the Bronx and Westchester in that congressional district need to hear as opposed to a Black candidate.
Well said. Well said.
Well said. Well said.
You remind me, we'll be talking about him later today. You remind me of Joe Lieberman in the sense Joe Lieberman would often endorse someone because he thought he was the better person for this position.
Yeah. But I think it really got him in a lot of trouble when he did it to Obama.
But he won as an independent after that, right?
As an independent.
Yeah, not as a Democrat. Yep. But his reputation, I was stellar, stellar. But again, I don't fault people who lay out reasoning, saying as you did today, Governor, I'm endorsing this person for the following reasons, and they're solid reasons. Thank you so much. Yeah. And should you decide to ever run again, I think we're going to be right there endorsing you as well.
After you endorse me, please drop me off at the nearest psychiatric facility so I can end my days in peace.
I think we'll be walking in with you as, patients with you. Thank you so much, Governor David A. Patterson. Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure to have you on the program. Stay tuned for more of The Rev and the Rabbi right here on 77 WABC. We'll be right back.
Reverend A.R. Bernard, Rabbi Joseph Potasnik, where faith matters. The Rev and the Rabbi, Talk Radio 77 WABC and the all-new WABCRadio.com.
Welcome back. I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
And I'm Reverend A.R. Bernard.
Reverend, I have someone who has a building name who I think was maybe the largest vote getter in the state of New York when he ran for the office of Attorney General. And I'm talking about Robert Abrams, a friend to so many, respected by so many, and we're very fortunate to have you on the program, Bob.
Well, Joe, thanks. Thanks a lot. I mean, once I was on a plane after I left public office, I was sitting on the aisle and I was coming back from Washington and a woman was coming up the aisle and she looked at me and she said, did you used to be somebody? So, when you're out of office, how quickly they forget. So it's nice to have somebody like you saying some nice things. I appreciate it.
Well, you've been a friend for many, many years. So we want to talk about Senator Joe Lieberman, who was very unique in that political arena. And you had, I know, a special relationship with him. Talk about him as you knew him.
Joe was the best. He was just absolutely the best. He was one of the great public servants of our time, a man of extraordinary ability, total integrity, incredible courage. I was so privileged to call him a friend. We worked together as a fellow attorneys general. He was the attorney general of Connecticut, and I was the attorney general of New York. And we shared many, many experiences together. And when my wife called me and said, "Bob, you won't believe it," a few days ago, when she told me that Joe passed away, I couldn't handle it. He was just such a terrific guy, and the public knew that because, in that race, I think you mentioned it in the prior segment, he lost the Democratic primary and ran for the United States Senate as an independent, and he won. Everybody mm-hmm. thought that it would be absolutely impossible, and he won because they saw who the man was. He transcended party lines and party dogma. And he was just a wonderful human being, a role model for all of us.
So what was it most about Joe Lieberman that captured you? I got to know him. We did a book signing together in Brooklyn, and we had a long conversation about the Sabbath. And I was so impressed with how he navigated his commitment to his faith and yet understood the practical issues that come into play when you have to make adjustments to that faith. And he saw the Sabbath not as a day to be worshiped, but as a principle to be practiced. And I really respected his whole take on that in his book. What was it about him that intrigued you?
He was genuine. He was... in public life and other facets of our society, we see people in public and they sort of wear a mask. With Joe, it was always real. It was genuine. He was a guy of incredible decency, and whoever he encountered, it didn't matter whether you were low, high, or in between. I mean, whether you were a taxi cab driver, a waiter, a dishwasher, or somebody who is preeminent in our society, I mean, all people were treated equally, and the sense of decency emerged. So, and on top of it all, even though he was this person of tremendous ability, had a very keen intellect, and he had so many fine qualities, he also was very humble. He was never full of himself. And, you know, the whatever position he had, whether it was in the state legislature, attorney general, United States senator, candidate for vice president, candidate for president, he always had this humility. And so he was truly a remarkable person. And I was so privileged to be able to earn his friendship. We did many things together over a 40-year period. My wife and I were devastated when we heard the news.
By the way, Bob, as one who's known you for many years, you have many of those qualities. You know, many times I've been with you, never call attention to, you know, yourself that much. You're always conferring plaudits on others. I want to tell you one quick story, and then I want to talk about your book. In Pittsburgh, Joe Lieberman was scheduled to speak at a hotel, and there were the cameras were there waiting for the arrival of the limousine. And he arrives, gets out, and Secret Service runs to the trunk of the car and takes out this long item enclosed in plastic. And people thought it's a rifle Secret Service is taking out. And it turned out to be a palm branch, the lulav, because that was the week of Sukkot, of Tabernacles, and it was an intermediate day when you could travel. So here he traveled campaigning with a lulav to show, I'm a proud American and I'm a proud Jew, and they're not antithetical.
And he never wore it on his sleeve. You know, that's the other thing. You know, that's who he was. That's part of the genuineness I was talking about. People would just would accept him, have to accept him for who he is. And so it was always unvarnished. It came straight from the shoulder, from the heart. And that's why he was admired by many. Look, a lot of people, you know, disdained him also because of his independence. He went against the grain many times on very controversial issues. There's another thing. Whoever, if he was opposed to somebody, it was never the discussion was never with meanness. It was never with disdain. It was never with anger. It was trying to get to the heart and the merits of what was at stake. And it always ended, you know, with a chuckle, with good humor, with decency, with warmth. I mean, he was an exceptional guy and somebody who we should always remember because of all the things he taught us.
Yeah, and that authenticity is probably why, as a Democrat, he was able to earn quite a bit of support from prominent conservatives. And, you know, that wasn't common. He was able to do that. And I think it's because of that authenticity and genuineness of which you speak.
And he was willing to cross, you know, party lines and go across the aisle and join hands with others. You know, create coalitions. He was a very wonderful guy, and just continues to pain me to think that we still don't have him in our midst. We desperately need that kind of humanity and leadership.
Bob, you consider yourself the luckiest guy in the world.
Well, Joe, that's the name of the book that I wrote a couple of years ago. It took me years to write it.
Right. Why? Why do you consider yourself the luckiest guy?
Well, I mean, there's a huge laundry list. because I'm still living and I'm going to approach my 86th birthday, because I married a wonderful woman and we're going to be, we're approaching in a few months our 50th anniversary, because the Lord gave me two fabulous daughters who gave me two wonderful sons-in-law, and they, the daughters and sons-in-law, produced eight grandchildren for me, all of whom, by the way, live in Jerusalem. Because I was able to lead a very exciting life. I never dreamt. My father had a candy store. He dropped out of high school to help earn some money for the family, to work in the family store. What an opportunity this country gave me. I never dreamt that I'd be able to lead such an exciting life, to be a member of the assembly, the legislature, to be the borough president of the Bronx, to represent a great diversity of people, Italians, Irish, African Americans, Hispanics, Jews, all coming together to live in the Bronx, 12 community boards trying to bring unity among all those communities. There was a car accident. I was running for borough president coming down from Albany, and I fell asleep at the wheel, and my car went off the road. I went off the embankment, and I got out of the car without a scratch and continued to drive down to New York City. I'm the luckiest guy in the world because, 12 years ago, I went to see a doctor, and he said, "You have a malignant tumor. We have to operate immediately." And he called it a well-differentiated liposarcoma. And he told me after the operation that it was 30 centimeters long and it weighed 25 pounds. And I needed 12 pints of blood during the operation. So, Joe, I think I'm a very lucky guy. And, in fact, the luckiest guy in the world.
Just tell the Reverend.
But you also, I was just going to say, but you also reached beyond your own faith and you were able to understand and build bridges of peace. Talk about the resolution of the controversy that the Jewish community had with the Latter-day Saints. Rabbi and I work with Elder David Buckner, and LDS has done a lot of work together with us, especially with our Commission of Religious Leaders. But you played a very important role in resolving a controversy between the Jewish community and LDS. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, I had a client. I was in private practice of law, and I had a client who was a member of the LDS Church. And we got to be very close. We worked together on the matter for a number of years. He was based in Arizona. He and his partner and colleagues were also from Phoenix, and they'd come up every month for several days. So we'd have meals together. So we got to be very, very friendly. And one day he said, "Would you be willing to bring a delegation of Jewish leaders to Salt Lake City to meet some folks in the LDS Church?" And I said, "Sure, but can you tell me why?" He said, "Well, just for the two communities to get to know each other better." And so as I tried to put together the list of leadership, somebody told me, "Bob, are you aware that there's current hostility between the two groups?" And I found out that there was a press conference by the Jewish community attacking the church, and it turned out to be a controversy relating to an element of the LDS faith that they believe that there should be an opportunity for proxy baptism.
Right.
And some members of the Jewish community, particularly those who survived the Holocaust, felt, "You mean that church is converting my brothers and sisters and members of my family who were murdered by the Nazis in the Holocaust, who died proudly as Jews?" And so there was a misunderstanding as to really what was taking place, but there was also a lot of hostility. So when I heard that, I was unaware of the circumstances, and I said, "Well, maybe, when I go there, I'll try to find out a little more about it." And so the delegation, a very prominent delegation, went, and I was talking to one of the elders of the church, and I raised this issue. I said, "What's this all about?" And he said, "It pains us that there has become this schism, this division," and he explained to me that there wasn't, you know, some conversion that was being forced upon people. He said, in our faith, we believe when a person passes away, you know, the soul lives on, and we give an option, an opportunity for the soul to accept a baptism, a proxy mm-hmm. baptism, and the soul could say yes or the soul could say no. So it's the soul that decides. And so I had a little further refinement and understanding, and I went back to New York, and little did I know that it would take me 18 months, but I talked with significant leadership in the Holocaust survivor community, and with the leadership of the LDS Church, and we worked out a joint statement of mutual understanding, and that began years of further friendship and warmth between the two groups, things that we did together. You know, and I found that there was so much reverent commonality between the two groups, even though obviously the Jewish community different from the LDS Church. But what did I find? I found that there was a real commitment to family, that there was a real commitment to education, that there was a real commitment to philanthropy, that there was a real commitment to success, hard work, disproportionate success within the community. And, you know, and there were so many fundamental values that were similar between the two groups. And so as time went on, there were more and more opportunities for us to get together. I then found out that there was one of the leaders of their community 175 years before, named Orson Hyde,
who
was directed to go to Israel, to Mount of Olives, and to do a dedicatory prayer and to say, this is the land of the Jewish people. It's going to be rebuilt with its capital, Jerusalem. And I found out that, gee whiz, that happened almost 175 years ago. And gee whiz, next year is going to be the 175th anniversary. And I said, maybe we should have a Jewish LDS delegation go and celebrate that anniversary. And we put together a number of people, including Rabbi Joseph Potasnik and Joe Lieberman, by the way. Mm-hmm. And we had this incredible meeting gathering in Jerusalem. So it's been a source of tremendous pride for me to be able to help be a bit bridge builder and put these two communities together. Yeah. And not only here in New York, but across the country, as we reach out and have dialogue and breakfasts and lunches and community conversations in various places throughout the United States, including
Well said. I'm glad you got a chance to share that, because Rabbi and I focused on interfaith dialogue, and it begins with finding common ground and common values, shared values. And we realize that we have more in common than we do differences.
And
so I'm really glad you got to share that story, Bob.
Thanks to Robert Abrams, we have developed a very special relationship with that community, and we do much together. So I would say, Bob, that we are also some of the luckiest people in the world in knowing you and
being
the beneficiaries of all the great things that you have done. The only thing I ask is, given your car driving experience, tell me where you're going to be for the week. I just want to avoid those streets. All right, Robert Abrams, former Attorney General of the State of New York. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, guys. Thank you very much.
All right. And stay tuned for more of The Rev and the Rabbi right here on 77 WABC. We'll be right back.
Welcome back. I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
And I'm Reverend A.R. Bernard.
Reverend, I have someone who has a building name who I think was maybe the largest vote getter in the state of New York when he ran for the office of Attorney General. And I'm talking about Robert Abrams, a friend to so many, respected by so many, and we're very fortunate to have you on the program, Bob.
Well, Joe, thanks a lot. I mean, you know, once I was on a plane after I left public office, I was sitting on the aisle, and I was coming back from Washington, and a woman was coming up the aisle, and she looked at me and she said, are you did you used to be somebody? So you know, when you're out of office, how quickly they forget. So it's nice to have somebody like you saying some nice things. I appreciate it.
Well, you've been a friend for many, many years. So we wanted to talk about Senator Joe Liebman, who was very unique in that political arena. And you had, I know, a special relationship with him. Talk about him as you knew him.
Joe was the best. He was just absolutely the best. He was one of the great public servants of our time. A man of extraordinary ability, total integrity, incredible courage. I was so privileged to call him a friend. We worked together as fellow attorneys general. He was the attorney general of Connecticut, and I was the attorney general of New York. And we shared many, many experiences together. And, you know, when my wife called me and said, Bob, you won't believe it, a few days ago, when she told me that Joe passed away, I couldn't handle it. He was just such a terrific guy, and the public knew that because, you know, in that race, I think you mentioned it in the prior segment, he lost the Democratic primary and ran for the United States Senate as an independent, and he won. Everybody mm-hmm. thought that it would be absolutely impossible, and he won because they saw who the man was. He transcended party lines and party dogma. And he was just a wonderful human being, a role model for all of us.
So what was it most about Joe Lieberman that captured you? I got to know him. We did a book signing together in Brooklyn, and we had a long conversation about the Sabbath. And I was so impressed with how he navigated his commitment to his faith, and yet understood the practical issues that come into play when you have to make adjustments to that faith. And he saw the Sabbath not as a day to be worshipped, but as a principle to be practiced. And I really respected his whole take on that in his book. What was it about him that intrigued you?
He was genuine. He was... You know, in public life and other facets of our society, we see people in public and they sort of wear a mask. With Joe, it was always real. It was genuine. He was a guy of incredible decency. And whoever he encountered, it didn't matter whether you were low, high, or in between. I mean, whether you're a taxi cab driver, a waiter, a dishwasher, or somebody who is preeminent in our society, I mean, all people were treated equally, and the sense of decency emerged. So, and on top of it all, even though he was this person of tremendous ability, had a very keen intellect, and he had so many fine qualities, he also was very humble. He was never full of himself. And, you know, the whatever position he had, whether it was in the state legislature, attorney general, United States senator, candidate for vice president, candidate for president, he always had this humility. And so he was truly a remarkable mm-hmm. person. And I was so privileged to be able to earn his friendship. We did many things together over a 40-year period. My wife and I were devastated when we heard the news.
By the way, Bob, as one who's known you for many years, you have many of those qualities. Many times I've been with you, never call attention to, you know, yourself that much. You're always conferring plaudits on others. I want to tell you one quick story, and then I want to talk about your book. In Pittsburgh, Joe Lieberman was scheduled to speak at a hotel, and the cameras were there waiting for the arrival of the limousine, and he arrives, gets out, and Secret Service runs to the trunk of the car and takes out this long item enclosed in plastic, and people thought it's a rifle Secret Service is taking out, and it turned out to be a palm branch, the lulav, because that was the week of Sukkot, of Tabernacles, and it was an intermediate day when you could travel. So here he traveled campaigning with the lulav to show, I'm a proud American and I'm a proud Jew, and they're not antithetical.
And he never wore it on his sleeve. You know, that's the other thing. That's who he was. That's part of the genuineness I was talking about. People would just have to accept him for who he is. And so it was always unvarnished. It came straight from the shoulder, from the heart. And that's why he was admired by many. Look, a lot of people, you know, disdained him also because of his independence. He went against the grain many times on very controversial issues. There's another thing. Whoever, if he was opposed to somebody, it was never the discussion was never with meanness. It was never with disdain. It was never with anger. It was trying to get to the heart and the merits of what was at stake. And it always ended, you know, with a chuckle, with good humor, with decency, with warmth. I mean, he was an exceptional guy and somebody who we should always remember because of all the things he taught us.
Yeah, and that authenticity is probably why, as a Democrat, he was able to earn quite a bit of support from prominent conservatives. And, you know, that wasn't common. He was able to do that. And I think it's because of that authenticity and genuineness of which you speak.
And he was willing to cross, party lines and go across the aisle and join hands with others. Create coalitions. He was a very wonderful guy, and it just continues to pain me to think that we still don't have him in our midst, because we desperately need that kind of humanity and leadership.
Bob, you consider yourself the luckiest guy in the world.
Well, Joe, that's the name of the book that I wrote a couple of years ago. It took me years to write it.
Right. Why? Why do you consider yourself the luckiest guy?
Well, I mean, there's a huge laundry list because I'm still living and I'm going to approach my 86th birthday because I married a wonderful woman and we're approaching in a few months our 50th anniversary because the Lord gave me two fabulous daughters who gave me two wonderful sons-in-law, and the daughters and sons-in-law produced eight grandchildren for me, all of whom, by the way, live in Jerusalem, because I was able to lead a very exciting life. I never dreamt. My father had a candy store. He dropped out of high school to help earn some money for the family, to work in the family store. What an opportunity this country gave me. I never dreamt that I'd be able to lead such an exciting life, to be a member of the assembly, the legislature, to be the borough president of the Bronx, to represent a great diversity of people, Italians, Irish, African Americans, Hispanics, Jews, all coming together to live in the Bronx, 12 community boards trying to bring unity among all those communities. There was a car accident. I was running for borough president coming down from Albany, and I fell asleep at the wheel, and my car went off the road. I went off the embankment, and I got out of the car without a scratch and continued to drive down to New York City. I'm the luckiest guy in the world because, I mean, 12 years ago, I went to see a doctor, and he said, "You have a malignant tumor. We have to operate immediately." And he called it a well-differentiated liposarcoma. And he told me after the operation that it was 30 centimeters long and it weighed 25 pounds. And I needed 12 pints of blood during the operation. So, Joe, I think I'm a very lucky guy. And, in fact, the luckiest guy in the world.
Just tell the Reverend.
But you also, I was just going to say, but you also reached beyond your own faith and you were able to understand and build bridges of peace. Talk about the resolution of the controversy that the Jewish community had with the Latter-day Saints. Rabbi and I work with Elder David Buckner, and LDS has done a lot of work together with us, especially with our Commission of Religious Leaders. But you played a very important role in, resolving a controversy between the Jewish community and LDS. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, I had a client. I was in private practice of law, and I had a client who was a member of the LDS Church. And we got to be very close. We worked together on the matter for a number of years. He was based in Arizona. He and his partner and colleagues were also from Phoenix, and they'd come up every month for several days. So we'd have meals together. So we got to be very, very friendly. And one day he said, would you be willing to bring a delegation of Jewish leaders to Salt Lake City to meet some folks in the LDS Church? And I said, sure, but can you tell me why? And he said, well, just for the two communities to get to know each other better. And so as I tried to put together the list of leadership, somebody told me, Bob, are you aware that there's current hostility between the two groups? And I found out that there was a press conference by the Jewish community attacking the church, and it turned out to be a controversy relating to an element of the LDS faith that they believe that there should be an opportunity for proxy baptism.
Right.
And some members of the Jewish community, particularly those who survived the Holocaust, felt, you mean that church is converting my brothers and sisters and members of my family who were murdered by the Nazis in the Holocaust, who died proudly as Jews? And so there was a misunderstanding as to really what was taking place, but there was also a lot of hostility. So when I heard that, I was unaware of the circumstances, and I said, well, maybe, when I go there, I'll try to find out a little more about it. And so the delegation, a very prominent delegation, went, and I was talking to one of the elders of the church, and I raised this issue. I said, what's this all about? And he said, it pains us that there has become this schism, this division. And he explained to me that there wasn't, some conversion that was being forced upon people. He said, in our faith, we believe when a person passes away, the soul lives on, and we give an option, an opportunity for the soul to accept a baptism, a proxy baptism, and the soul could say yes or the soul could say no. So it's the soul that decides. And so I had a little further refinement and understanding, and I went back to New York, and little did I know that it would take me 18 months, but I talked with significant leadership in the Holocaust survivor community, and with the leadership of the LDS Church, and we worked out a joint statement of mutual understanding, and that began years of further friendship and warmth between the two groups, things that we did together. And I found that there was so much reverent commonality between the two groups, even though,
obviously,
the Jewish community different from the LDS Church. But what did I find? I found that there was a real commitment to family, that there was a real commitment to education, that there was a real commitment to philanthropy, that there was a real commitment to success, hard work, disproportionate success within the community. And there were so many fundamental values that were similar between the two groups. And so as time went on, there were more and more opportunities for us to get together. I then found out that there was one of the leaders of their community 175 years before, named Orson Hyde,
who was directed
to go to Israel, to Mount of Olives, and to do a dedicatory prayer and to say, this is the land of the Jewish people. It's going to be rebuilt with its capital, Jerusalem. And I found out that, gee whiz, that happened almost 175 years ago. And gee whiz, next year is going to be the 175th anniversary. And I said, maybe we should have a Jewish LDS delegation go and celebrate that anniversary. And we put together number of people, and including Rabbi Joseph Potasnik and Joe Lieberman, by the way. Mm-hmm. And we mm-hmm. had this incredible meeting gathering in Jerusalem. So it's been a source of tremendous pride for me to be able to help be a bit bridge builder and put these two communities together. Yeah. And not only here in New York, but across the country, as we reach out and have dialogue and breakfasts and lunches and community conversations in various places throughout the United States, including right
now. Well said. I'm glad you got a chance to share that, because Rabbi and I focused on interfaith dialogue. And it begins with finding common ground and common values, shared values. And we realize that we have more in common than we do differences.
And
so I'm really glad you got to share that story, Bob.
Thanks to Robert Abrams, we have developed a very special relationship with that community, and we do much together. So I would say, Bob, that we are also some of the luckiest people in the world in knowing you and being the beneficiaries of all the great things that you have done. The only thing I ask is, given your car driving experience, tell me where you're going to be for the week. I just want to avoid those streets. All right, Robert Abrams, former Attorney General of the State of New York. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here. Thank you very much.
Yeah. It was such a great interview with Bob Abrams and, of course, with Governor David Patterson. It was a great show today, Rabbi.
Yeah, because they spoke in a very personal way. It wasn't scripted. Yeah. They knew what they were speaking about. They knew who they were speaking about, and that comes across. You talk about authenticity, they're both very authentic.
Yeah. And we thank you, our audience, for joining us here on WABC every Sunday with the dynamic duo, the Rev and the Rabbi. We'll be back next week. God bless.